I put up some heat because it's cold in here. I don't know if it'll actually work, but if I deciphered that thermostat right, it will. If it gets too warm, let me know. Secondly, if you didn't put your birthplace on the list of birthplaces, please do that before you leave today. And then Donna can do whatever she's going to do with that. She's going to make a map so we can see where we all came from to get to this place. I think it's a cool idea. Thirdly, about the life story books, or book at this point. Does anybody have the green book?
Lost, red book.
Lost River. The red book is over there. Oh. If you want to borrow it over the break, I guess you can. You might think over the break of putting something in the life story book and make two copies, give two copies to Donna, and she'll put it in one book.
Give the other one to your
mom. Oh, and put it, that's right, you put the other one on our website.
We're going to tell the police about the class.
I'll make that announcement in a minute.
Okay,
so, okay, so we're sort of focused. Okay, let's get on. So I think I'd like to start with announcements today before we meditate. So announcements. Who has announcements? Okay. Peter.
Okay. I'd like to announce that Dr. Raymond Moody, who is the grandfather of the near-death and shared-death experience, will be coming to Santa Barbara next Wednesday evening to give a presentation. It's his second visit to Santa Barbara in 40 years. He wrote Life After Life, which sold more than 14 million copies. And so he is here at Trinity Episcopal giving a presentation from 6:30 to 8 on Wednesday, March 19th. And there's some flyers over here.
That's this coming Wednesday.
Yes.
And Trinity Episcopal is 1500 State.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Right.
So it's the beautiful cathedral on State Street. Julie, you had an announcement?
They thought they have fucking up register by on Tuesday.
Okay, so let me announce, I guess, let's first let you in. Okay. The spring term of this class starts, I think, on April 11th.
Yeah.
But you can start registering as of next Tuesday.
It will be
same as this term, 8 weeks, same price, $60.
I got a scholarship for it.
Good for you.
The only change is that we'll start at 10:15 in the spring. So we'll go 10:15 to 11:45. I will start promptly at 10:15. You can actually get here the same time as you usually get here. And it's about the right time.
You start at 10:15 anyway.
No, we usually start at 10:05, but it's later every week. Okay, so 10:15 to 11:45 in the spring. And I already have three guest speakers. I'll probably have four of the eight classes be guests.
What were the three?
I won't tell you.
Surprise.
Surprise, yes.
Is David Rico speak in April?
Say again?
David Rico
will be one. David Rico will always speak in the spring, yeah.
Yeah, I like okay.
All right, let's see. Other announcements? Other announcements? So, seeing them. Let me talk a little bit about mindfulness and we'll sit. First of all, you can do any kind of meditation you want in these 10 minutes. Mindfulness is only the suggested activity. Activity is kind of the wrong word. Three things I want to remind you about mindfulness. First thing is the greatest temptation when you become aware of what's going on here, the weather. The greatest temptation is to fix the weather, right? Oh, I could think differently. I could get rid of that thought. Maybe if I could make that feeling flow a little better, you know, I could put some healing energy into my knee, you know. We're so accustomed to working on the world and ourselves that the temptation is always to immediately, when you perceive something that is not to your liking, to go to it, to tinker with it. In Buddhism, that they say that and that alone is the cause of your suffering. Attachment, right? Grasping. And the way out of suffering is to stop grasping. However, I can't quite master that. I want to fix things. I want things to get better. I'm not that enlightened to just say it's all okay the way it is. Or I see the perfection in it the way it is. So I have a sneaky way to fix things. The sneaky way to fix things is not to try to fix things directly, but rather to create space, spaciousness in your consciousness, in which the weather can be the way that it is. So you become a breathing and an infinite field of consciousness, an infinitely open sky of consciousness, in which there is whatever thought, feeling, and sensation, weather, happening. So if you have a difficulty, the idea is not, don't go to the difficulty. Pull back from the difficulty to open your awareness more and more spaciously, create more and more space to include everything. Now, why is that a sneaky way to fix things? Because by creating the opening, the spaciousness, the allowing, the acceptance of things as they are, contractions naturally expand. They naturally open into the space around them. So if I have a difficulty and I can create this accepting open space, it is the way that it is. It's raining right now. Open, 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 so that I am embracing that rainingness. Then the rain rains itself out swiftly and sun comes out again. So by not trying to fix things, but by accepting them the way that they are and creating space for them to be the way that they are, they maximally quickly heal themselves. Understand?
Yes.
So when you find yourself objecting to something or wrestling with something, just breathe, open the awareness infinitely in all directions. Just let your edges go away at the boundaries. Just feel more and more spacious and see what happens. Second thing to remember, if you sit and you get the spaciousness part pretty well, but you get the spaced out part with it, then, you know, because it's really nice to sit and just kind of let go, and then you might do a little labeling. Remember labeling? Just for a minute or two, say, this, just call out to yourself what you're aware of, predominantly aware of. It's like going like this with a camera lens, it focuses it. So you might do a little labeling so that you balance the two activities of mindfulness, or the two, they're not activities, they're not efforts, the two things we're doing when we're mindful. One is we're letting go progressively more and more at every level. And the second thing we're doing is we're tuning in more and more precisely to what's happening on every level. So the labeling is a way to be very aware even as one opens and opens and opens and opens. And then the third thing to remind you of is many of us like to do some active direction of our awareness once we get a focused awareness. We like to do metta, put people in our hearts, maybe pray for people, do various things that we know how to do with our consciousness. I suggest if you're going to do those active directions of awareness, that first you sit in mindfulness for a few minutes so that you've got an open awareness and a gathered point of view. And then toward the end of your sitting, you very consciously direct your attention here, 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 wherever you want it to go, to have maximal effect. If your attention is kind of scattered, it's not very powerful. But when your attention is very gathered, very focused, then you can put it somewhere for maximum effect. So if you're going to do something active, do it as the second phase of your meditation after you let go, breathe, open up, become mindful. Any question or comment before we sit? Al.
I didn't hear Mark Meekle from the beginning, know him at a retreat, and he talked about the concept, you know, your first concept, accepting.
Loud.
Putting spaciousness around. He called it befriending your experience. And I found that to be very helpful. Whether a friend sometimes will say something you don't necessarily like, or the feel way that you befriend me anyway. You don't just reject it. Get into an area of place, and I've been befriending my experience these last 2 weeks, and it has been wonderfully helpful. So I pass that on to you.
Yeah, the attitude you take toward the weather, which was who you thought, this is who you thought you were. The attitude you take from here is a self-compassionate attitude. You know, you look at the you that suffers. And you go, oh, you're such a sweet person, and you try so hard, you love stuff so much. Okay, all right. On that note, let me sit. Oh, it's warm enough now, right?
Yes.
All right, let me turn this thing off so you don't get blasted out of here. Temperature the same as it is. That's all we're letting you. Okay, here we go. We'll sit for 10 minutes.
The question is why you would ever go back to being the storm when you could stay at the sky. I asked my friend Michael Gilbert to come and talk to you for just a very few minutes about the class that he's going to start this spring at CLL. I first became aware of Michael through this book that he wrote called The Disposable Male, Sex, Love, and Money Through Darwin's Eyes. I'll give him a little introduction. Michael Gilbert is a senior fellow at the Annenberg Center for the Digital Future at the University of Southern California, where researchers track the ways in which digital technologies, the internet, and virtual communities are changing the social, political, and economic fabric of our lives. But this particular book is about something I'm very interested in that I don't know enough about, so Michael, this is a huge resource. It's about evolutionary psychology. The idea that everything we think, feel, and do has had some utilitarian purpose, and so it has been selected for. So with that introduction, I'll let Michael say a few words to you so that you become interested in his class. And Michael, do you want a microphone?
I don't think it's necessary. Can everybody hear me? Or?
No.
Okay. I have to learn how to project like this anyway. Thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be able to introduce my class in this story of class. I see that you've broken out of the confines of small classrooms here. They wouldn't hold you any longer. In any event, this is a new class. Some of you may have picked up the flyer over here. And it's based, as Spencer's indicated, in the field of evolutionary psychology, which really draws together, or attempts to draw together, the thinking around evolution and natural selection and apply it in terms of understanding human behavior. The course is called View Your World Through Darwin's Eyes, and what I want to do with this class is not so much teach the issues around evolution, although that's certainly going to be part of the program, but rather to use that perspective, the point of view of evolution, for looking at some of the interesting things that are going on in our lives, either politically around us, culturally, or even in our personal lives. And in other words, apply this thinking fairly immediately. Not so much teaching as guiding what I hope will be vibrant conversations about an evolutionary perspective on life. And let me give you an example of just take a few minutes to give you a kind of typical thing that I'm talking about. Every year, the U.S. Census Bureau issues some statistics on children in this country born out of wedlock. The number is astonishing to me every year I hear it, and it has risen dramatically since the 70s. And currently, 40% of American children are born out of wedlock. In the minority communities, amongst the African American community, it's over 70%. Amongst Hispanics, it's over 50%. Now, obviously, this can lead into a provocative discussion about the future of fatherhood, what does that mean, and also the future of families, if fathers are disappearing from the scene. Obviously, we'll have that talk, but the evolutionary aspects of this would be things like, we're the only primates where fatherhood is actually attached to a child. Among the other primate species, there is a knowledge amongst the males of who the children of the troop are, of who the tribe are, and perhaps a male elder will mentor a young male that he draws in. But there's no connection between a father and a child. We're the only primates who do that. Also, an evolutionary context would be, let's see how other cultures around the world have traditionally or permanently deal with the issue of fatherhood. One of my favorite expressions, it's a great African proverb and it appears in the book, And I just love it about this issue, and it's mama's baby, papa's maybe. We know who the mother is. We can see that with our own eyes. This is one of the reasons why, for instance, in the Jewish faith, the line is traced through the mother rather than the father. We're going to be looking at those kinds of issues through an evolutionary lens. Let me give you an example of a few other kinds of things. And students will be welcome to bring this in, bring topics into the class. But we'll pick things from the news. For instance, this issue of stand your ground in Florida has been in the Trayvon Martin case, and now more recently in a bunch of teenagers making a loud noise. We are, I guess, the kings and queens of our castle, but does this mean that if some teenagers wander onto our lawn at 2 in the morning playing loud music that we can shoot at? And obviously the answer is no. But nevertheless, we have a very powerful instinct around territoriality. We want ground. We want a whole land. That's where resources are. And this manifests itself in things like the Russians now grabbing at Crimea. And is the basis for a lot of war and a lot of things like that that go on. So we're going to bring in topical subjects. I hope to make it a perennial for that reason, and something that will be a repeat course. And my hope is that students will come away from this. I don't expect to turn any of you into crypto neo Darwinians. Although there may be a few of you already here in this room, you know who you are. I hope that what we can convey is a distinctive new way for you, if you're not already looking at the world through Darwinian eyes, through evolutionary eyes, is to perhaps develop a perspective that you can add to all the other ways that you examine life, many of which are nurtured here in this room. As a new and different added way. And if that fails, hopefully at least half a dozen interesting evenings of provocative, spirited discussion. The flyers are over there, and Darwin is the guy on the top with the long beard. And I'll be here for the rest of this class. It's been my pleasure to attend it from time to time. And so if any of you want to come up and talk to me later with a specific question, I'd be pleased to see you. Thank you so much.
Michael, what night is it?
It's Tuesday evenings, 7:15 to 9:15. It's at Wake. I'm the new guy on the block. I asked for to be here a shot, but they put me at Wake. It starts on April 8th, I believe. Six Tuesdays from 7:15 to 9:15.
Perfect. Okay. This is Michael Gilbert. Thank you. Okay, now it is my, are you going out, Marty? You're coming up. Okay.
I'm coming up.
Good. Okay, so now it is my pleasure to, and here's the microphone, to reintroduce Marty Glenn, Dr. Marty Glenn, who talked to us. Most of you were here a couple of weeks ago, so you remember that what we were talking about is the influence of gestation and birth on child and adult functioning, on who you are. And also, if it will come in, the question of how these early experiences are stored in our bodies and how we can work with these really, really early formative experiences. Because if you sit, I think talk therapy by itself is not going to do it. Okay, so what way do you want to do it, Marty?
Well, first I'm going to start with an apology.
No, don't even.
No, I have to. For me, this is for you, this is for me. I have never, ever in my life forgotten a class in 30-some years of teaching. And I had several emergencies, canceled my clients for the week, and I didn't know it was Friday. I mean, that's the truth. And I got a call from you that afternoon, and I went, oh, you know what? So anyway, I do apologize, and you're so gracious to have me back. I thought, you know, maybe I could bake them all brownies or something. Anyway, I'm appreciating our topic and our time together. It was so rich, and I just loved it. So just thinking about how those very early experiences create ongoing lenses through which we look and experiences in our current lives. If we look at, just to recap, the noble points in our existence for creating a foundation for our personality, our lens in the world, and how we are, begins, there's one before conception that we talked about, whether or not the environment is stressful. Believe it or not, one of the most important things is whether or not we are wanted. Huge, 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 huge. If you were, or if someone, you know, I have worked with people who were their mother's failed abortion. I mean, that is huge in our lives. So that's almost like the second imprint. Then the third is when we come through gestation, and is this an accepting, loving, fairly stress, no pregnancy is stress-free, but, you know, sometimes in pregnancy, mom is very anxious or very depressed, or there's a lot going on in her life that she has no control over. That has an effect. Then the next one is the birth process itself and what happens there. What are the experiences? And we can go into that more. And then the next one is right after birth and the first few days, weeks, and months of life, how is that attachment relationship continued? And what we find is that those are experiences that are stored not in our, it's implicit, not explicit memory. It's stored like in body memory. It's not stored in, oh, I remember that. But you may remember some of the stories I told that were pretty graphic about people that had memories and they could see the whole experience. It happened before they were born. So these experiences have an effect, and what happens when we have any experience, we, I'll just use myself as an example. If I told the story already, you can forgive me before I start. But in my example, my mother's sister had just died in childbirth before she got pregnant with me. So you can imagine she was, you know, anxious. And as I've worked on my early experience, what I've come to realize, or I've experienced in some deep birth work or trance work or whatever you want to call it, some more body-oriented work, as you were saying, is that I thought I had to take care of my mother. I mean, that was the only way I could make sense of what was going on outside. And I couldn't take care of her, and therefore I must not be smart. So if you think you're not smart your whole life, do you know what you do? You go straight away and get a PhD. That's what we do. And then you still don't think you're smart. But we keep learning and growing and so on. But it's that kind of experience. All of us have had one. And we believe something, not in a conscious way, but in an unconscious body way, that somehow some part of me is not okay. Some part of me is not acceptable. I'm not good enough, nice enough, smart enough. I'm not wanted. I shouldn't be here. All kinds of things. And so what we like to do is get to what is the thing that's in your way now? And the way we do it is we take a current experience and trace it back. In fact, we could do that if we had time. And trace it back and find that early, early experience. So those are some things we can do. We can do it another time if we want. But it's not like pie in the sky, oh yeah, that's really interesting. It's very concrete. And when we get back there and begin to work on that, and it's like, no. You see a little precious little child, are they not lovable? No. You can see as an adult how loving and precious that little one was. And you can begin to change through some of these methods that I've been learning here. Begin to change some of that. Does that make sense at all? Mm-hmm. So I want to turn it over to you to see what questions you have. Yeah. Yes?
I'll start off. Good.
All right, so I think in Marty's article, she mentions various patterns that we have based on various things that have happened in gestation and birth. So I thought I'd be specific. When I was born, they tell me that I was pulled out
with high forceps.
Oh.
And there was more. There was a lot more. But that part of it was, I'll just do that part of it. So what does that mean for my adult personality? And then I'll tell you what I make of it.
Oh, okay, good. I don't know. It's not like, I can tell you had high forceps. We know about you. It's not that at all. But we would get very curious and ask you, have you noticed in your life, for example, a resistance to authority or a feeling that just get a, you know,
pretty good so far.
And just that much, thank you. I appreciate you being loyal to your person. By the way, this is very personal. We're making a joke of it because it's kind of fun. But this is really in our bones. It's very deep, and it's our life pattern. And I'm being very funny, but it's not funny. So I apologize, and I appreciate you using yourself as an example. But that's right. Usually someone, particularly with high forceps, do you know what forceps are? We don't really use them anymore. Yeah. But forceps are where they take these big spoons, huge spoons, and they go in and used to place them around the baby's head, you know, like here. Because the baby is not descending for whatever reason. Sometimes it's a cord around the neck, sometimes there are various reasons. But it saves the baby's life sometimes, but it leaves an impression. And if we don't go back and say, oh, this happened to you, and that wasn't your fault, and this is what it is, then they can work through it. It's pretty amazing.
There's another aspect to it also. I think you mentioned, I have always had this idea that somebody would rescue me.
And somebody
absolutely would pull me through.
Yeah. So sometimes, sometimes there's a resistance to authority, but there's, if somebody is a breech baby, is another one, if you get pulled out, a C-section baby, you may find, let me back up just a second here, what we find is that what happened to us at our birth, because birth is our biggest transition in our life, that kind of sets a little bit of a thumbprint or a template that we tend to repeat every time we go through a transition. So you might think about your own life and think about when have been my big transitions? When you moved, you started a new job, you started something, you had an idea, you had a dream, something like that. How did you respond? And is there a pattern? And sometimes you go backwards. And somebody says, you know, I get to wherever and I just give up, you know. In my own case, my mother had a lot of anesthesia. So when I was born, I was out. And so what happens for me is I get to a transition, and I'm ready to go, and I go, it's not so important. That's okay. It'll be all right. You know, I don't push through to the end. I mean, I've learned to overcome that, but I watch that tendency in me to get to the end and go, maybe not. You know. So whatever that pattern is, you may go backwards and go, you know, I notice. Get to the doorway and I rush right through. Or I get to the doorway and what? You know? Pretty interesting. So what does this bring up for you? Yes.
Well, this may be too big to answer, but I have a nephew and he's married and while his wife was pregnant, they were robbed and tied up and at a young point.
Oh.
During the pregnancy, and they now have a 3-year-old son, and my nephew hasn't really gotten over the incident, whereas the mother doesn't really talk about it. And I guess my question is how that's going to affect their child later in life? Or...
Well, there are many incidences. There have been a lot of studies that were done during 9/11 with women that were pregnant. Some of the Eastern European countries where there was a lot of war and rape and that kind of thing, there have been a lot of studies done with that, as well as just in our own lives. This kind of thing, unfortunately, is not as uncommon as we'd like for it to be, but there are traumas that happen. You know, someone dies in the family, or the house burns down, or something like that. And this particular thing is a huge trauma, and sometimes the person who is the victim doesn't want to talk about it because it's so terrifying, but it is still there. And it has to be worked through at some point. She may not be ready yet. And the little one, you know, it's going to have some effect. And it's not like, oh, we better go, you know. But I would just watch and go, very interesting. What we notice in children like this, sometimes they'll have night terrors, or they'll start wetting the bed, or they'll refuse to go to nursery school, or they'll be very, very clingy all of a sudden at certain times. So they're exhibiting some kind of behavior that's not age appropriate. And, you know, some people would say, well, they just need to buck up and we just need to have them, whatever. But that's not the case. We need to look at what's underneath that and what experience might this child have had that's trying to get worked out through their body. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's like 3 years old now, the child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's highly intelligent. He's bilingual. He
reads.
He's, I went to buy a present. I said, I need a present for a three-year-old, but I think he's real intelligent, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
you know, sure.
Nowadays, you don't know.
No, I'm sure he is.
He's stubborn.
Huh.
But he's real independent,
mm-hmm.
But who knows, you know.
It may not manifest, at all, but it may manifest when he's 12 or 13. Just as he goes into puberty, a lot of times we found that kids right at that prepubescent age will reenact their birth. I know. So, I may have told you last time I helped to start an inpatient treatment center for teens. And we discovered that over and over and over again. It's like, okay. So you figure out what a kid's birth is and you kind of watch for it when they get, you know, when they get to be 13. Or support them, you know, and they start acting out. You go, that's what that is. You know? Yes?
I was breastfed until I was 5 years old.
Great.
It's not because my mother wanted to, it's because I wouldn't let go. And she would just give me real food, and I said, no, I don't want that. So I go and grab her breast and start sucking on.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, you know, I had a younger sister, so the milk kept flowing.
Yeah.
What does that tell you about me?
Let's see, how much time do you have? No. You know, there are some children that want that security. We all want security. And little ones, if that's their security blanket, you know, and they haven't learned to transfer that to themselves, they haven't learned to self-regulate as well as they might, then that's what they do. And good for your mom. You know, that's what you needed, that's what you got. I don't see anything wrong with it. I mean, I wouldn't shame somebody for doing that. I think it's helpful when a child begins to grow up to begin to give them other ways and work on having them be more self-regulatory. But, you know, thank God she had, you know, you had her. She didn't shame you. She didn't push you away. She just said, come here, you know. So I just think you needed that comfort.
So can I add, because I know Abraham. So Abraham, forgive me.
You asked the question, right? I'm going to tell some information. Can I do so? Can I give you an interpretation?
Sure, sure, sure.
Okay, so I'm going to give you two consequences of what you just said, one very positive and one a little less. The very positive one is you expect to be nurtured.
Mm. Wow.
The world, you know, you have no compunction about sharing your stuff. You expect that people will like it. They will. That they will like you. You just got a lot of nurturance early in your life. You weren't deprived. You know, you feel like you are a lovable person, and love is what you're about. And you got a lot of love, and you give a lot of love. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that you got the best kind of, you know, physical food love that you could get for as long. It was a great supply for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the real good part. The part that is not bad, but influenced by this is you like to have a lot of attention because you're always doing stuff like I am to get attention. It feeds you. I think that's part of that pattern of wanting nurturance from other people. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, when I look at my own life and why I'm in front of a lot of people, I think that I kind of want nurturance more than most people. I mean, we're willing to stand up here and make fools out of ourselves for the nurture, for the attention. So those are the two aspects.
I appreciate you sharing.
It goes this.
I have the same problem. You know how I'm between other people, you know, I need attention, I feel isolated. Yeah. I have the same problem.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that helps us as much as anything is exactly what you're doing here. The self-awareness. If there's something I want to shift, some pattern in my life that I want to shift, whether it doesn't matter where it comes from, but to begin to shift it, I use the mindfulness. I use the knowing when I'm off kilter. You know, knowing, oh, yeah, there that is again. Okay, I see myself raising my hand. I mean, I was one always sitting right where you're sitting, right in front of the class. You know, and I'm right here, and there's a whole class behind me. And when I started in therapy, I had to make myself quiet because it wasn't about me, right? So I think the awareness, more than anything, can be very, very helpful with that.
I was quickened when you said, I also was brought out by forces. And I was quickened when you said that a forceps baby does not descend
properly. That's right.
And
they don't get to do it themselves.
I'm just experiencing in my life right now a willingness to descend.
Wow.
Because I've been in conscious evolution, transcending, and in ACOA, an exercise that we had where, you know, you're in the middle and you've got to get through this maze of people. So I just went over the top like that.
Sure.
So say more about a forceps baby doesn't properly descend.
Hmm. Well, this would be true. Thank you, honey. This would be true for who? What babies don't go actually descend properly? C-section. Now we have vacuum extraction instead of forceps. But what happens, it's a little suction cup they put on the baby's head. When the baby comes out, they have a little bruise on their head. But the thought is it's better than a C-section. You know, if the baby's not descending, and sometimes the cord is around the neck, so they can't, and that's really a stuck place. I don't know if you had that or not. But if you don't descend, because the cord is around your neck, you're in a double bind. If I do what I'm supposed to do, I cut off my oxygen, and I'll die. If I don't do what I'm supposed to do, I can't go anywhere, and I'll die. And in that case, you may find yourself in a double bind a lot of the time, right? So if you're not descending, sometimes the message is, I don't know how to do this, I can't do it on my own, or I was doing everything right and they made me do something I wasn't ready to do. It's not in my timing. They should have given me some more time, or just leave me alone kind of feeling. It's different for everybody. It's not like one blanket thing, but it is very interesting. If you think about the baby's lungs get stimulated through that process, and there is a feeling of accomplishment when you make it out with no help. And the baby is the one who does that. You use your feet and you make it into the world. That's very different than metaphorically somebody coming in and pulling you out because you couldn't make it, right?
Can I add to that? If general anesthesia was used, then the baby doesn't have that experience of...
That's right.
Fighting, you know, cooperating with mama and triumphing. There's no feeling of the impetus to make great things happen and the will to make great things happen. There's just kind of like, it just kind of happens and, you know, that force isn't there. So the whole generation of us, they got robbed of that substrate of effort and success. And we wonder why some people have that thing where, you know, they can achieve great things, and how come I can't achieve great things? You know, I was asking, because I just don't, it's not in my body.
Right.
It's not in my body to know how to do that.
How many of you think your mother had anesthesia, like full-on anesthesia? If you were born before 1958, you probably did. Unless you had, sometimes that women were lucky and they were born at home or spontaneously or, you know, whatever. But it does have an effect. Mine was a little bit different than that. I sort of go to sleep at the end, but I had a sense that when the anesthesia was coming on, I had to move really fast to save my life. I mean, that was my sense. And I found myself at a conference one time with several thousand people in a big convention center, and I needed to get to the top, and I moved my way around really fast all the way up to the left-hand side, and I went, whoa. And I felt this voice say, I don't know where I'm going, but I'm going to be the first one there. What? But it was that sense of, I don't know what I'm going to move. I've just got to keep moving. And now, in a crisis like we had a couple weeks ago in our family, it's like, okay, I'm the one out there making decisions. Are those decisions good and right? Not necessarily. But I'm going to take action. My husband, on the other hand, you know, he's kind of a thinker. I'm going, we got to take action. He's going, and between the two of us, we seem to manage to do pretty well. But it's those early imprints. And for some of us, there is that, the anesthesia that comes on. It's so lovely. No problem. Yes.
I shared the room with my twin sister.
Oh.
I came out first.
Yes.
We were premature.
Uh-huh. How premature?
I don't know.
Were your lungs developed?
As far as I know.
Okay.
My sister got very ill. I mean, she had strep pneumonia or something. She still has a little hole in her back.
So oh, wow.
I don't know what they did. We were in a very small town. It was the hometown doctor that delivered us. There was a hospital there. We were put into a Cooksville oven incubator because that's all they had to keep us warm. She spent the first year, I think, in and out of the hospital. They would take me, and that was 25 miles away.
Wow.
So I guess I went with them, and I know they told me that's where I learned to walk, that I would go into the room and reach out my hand and try to reach to her. And then later I talked to my mother, and she didn't tell me a lot. If I wanted to know if we were identical, she really didn't know. I don't think we are, but I think if you saw her, you really know that we belong together.
Yeah.
And our relationship has been like Derby Van, and we'll way out, mm-hmm. and back to the
post. Just like it was in the beginning. You were very close, and then she got pulled away, and then she came back and continued
so
that way.
She to follow me wherever I go.
Yeah.
I went to Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah.
I came out here, she's here now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But that does make sense, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The twin experience, is anybody else in here who's a twin? Yes?
I'm a fraternal twin.
Yes?
A sister. And I also was the corset baby. I came out feet first.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember my mother always treating me with such disdain because I hurt her coming out.
Oh.
But yet my twin sister was treated with a lot of love and caring. And I think the reason I want to get out there and help people mm-hmm. is because I don't want other people to hurt the way
wow.
I was hurt.
Wow.
Emotionally.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But it's just that way. My twin sister and I are the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very giving, want to help. Mm-hmm. She's taking.
Yeah.
She has to be
yeah.
in control.
Yeah.
You know?
Fascinating to look at. And we would work with that in looking at what does that little one believe about herself as a result of mother's anger? Mm-hmm. You know?
And I used to be afraid of authority figures
mm-hmm.
until I started learning mindfulness meditation.
Yeah. Oh,
then
wonderful.
I started realizing they're no better than any of the rest of us. They're just human beings.
That's
with
right.
a different job.
That's right.
You know, and I learned to relax and be myself
mm-hmm.
and things work.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. But you can see those early experiences that create an imprint and have an effect on us until we shift them through mindfulness or therapy or going back or whatever. Yes.
As a practical matter,
mm-hmm.
some of us older people, my family is all gone.
Yes.
My brothers, my mother, you know, the whole family. I would love to know what happened back in that time. Are there medical records maybe to go back to the Civil War? Do I do it through retrogression?
That's a very good question.
This is fascinating, but my history is diaspora.
Yeah. Most of my things that I've discovered about myself were long after my mother died. Where do you think the memory is stored? Is it in the hospital records?
No.
Not really. You know, sometimes they're not even accurate. And they're not detailed. Where is the memory?
You.
In your body.
How?
Your body.
Yes.
Right.
And fascinating, I may have talked to you last time when I was doing therapy in the 70s and we were all on the big pillows on the floor and you know, we'd have people just go into a place, and they'd be in this deep space of not many words, and I would say, let your body do what it knows how to do. And sometimes, and we know now, sometimes we could just support the head a little bit. You know, they'd start coming over, and we support the head, and pretty soon the body would work through whatever it was that needed to be worked through, and sometimes it was hurt. So the body knows how to make those actions and how to tell you, and the truth is, it doesn't matter, did it happen this way or was it that? It's not the facts of what happened. It's what kind of sense we made internally about what happened. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, you know, when you go into, sometimes it's a hypnotic place or go into your body, sometimes in a meditative space with an intention, there are a lot of different ways to do it. Sometimes breath work. We'll facilitate that, but just being curious and open. You might even ask your dreamer, is there some part of me stuck back there that I need to look at? And notice your dreams over the next few days or weeks. Wait, let's see, you have a hand up.
As a hypnotherapist, I ask the higher self to
yes.
take you back to the cause or source.
That's
and
right.
And invite you to get out of the way.
That's right.
And just go there and find out what
that's
happened
right. That's right.
from your own perception of that particular time and place.
That's right. And
you
would be so healing. We'd be so proud of you. Yeah. Take us back to the source of this difficulty. And your body knows, right?
Your body knows.
And you go in that hypnotic state back
and boom, you're open, it arises. Thank you.
Hi. Is there a formal relationship mapping with this natal and neonatal experiences that affects or relates to the infant strange situation and the adult attachment scenario?
Interesting. Talking about the attachment theory and the initial way that they measure, we measure attachment, which is how securely attached an infant is to his or her mother. And they discovered there were several different categories. One was secure, and I'm not going to talk about the infant ones because there's 15 different categories, but basically they were either securely attached to mom, or they, you know, were a little more dismissing, or they were ambivalent. They were kind of, I want you, but I'm scared, and you come here, come here, come here, but I don't know if you're going to be there, kind of thing. And what they just discovered was that in adulthood, in our relationships, we do the same thing. Whatever happened to us then, we carry over into our adult relationships. So in a way, it's the same thing. I don't think anybody in the infant strange situation has looked at birth, but we know that whatever happened to you in those early moments, before birth, during birth, right after birth, that sets up how emotionally available your mother is, how you feel about that, how you're able to receive the nurturing that's there, and that determines how you're going to do with the infant strange situation. You know, when at a year old, if your attachment to your mother is measured, that's how it would be determined. So it's a great thread. Yes, the attachment people don't map it, but we do.
Does the father have anything to do with this? I mean,
Thank you. The father is very, very, very important, and I'm so appreciating your work. And you know, it's a little scary to think dads may be drifting off the map here, but fathers are vital to all of us, and anybody I've ever worked with, including myself, I used to say, I'm having father issues. I never had a father. That was pretty good. And then I began to look and I went, I have been looking for my father my entire life. And I didn't even know it. So the father is primary. If you think about the mother, the baby in the mother's arms, the mother is in the father's arms there. You know, either beside or behind, the father is there to have a relationship with the child and to support the mom. And they are, you know, in the ideal situation, they're a triangle. It is really difficult for a single mom to raise a kid by herself, you know, particularly an infant. They need that triangle. And we don't always have it in our culture, particularly in some of the, you know, some communities. And in some of those communities, there's extended family that come in, which can be helpful. But it's a shame because guess who else loses out? It's the dad. You know, dad loses out. Dad is yearning for that child, and the child is yearning for dad. And it's a need that I would like to see us address a little better as a culture, quite frankly. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. Yes?
I haven't been able to get the example out of my head when you were here last time, and I wanted to ask you the story about the lady who went to England. Whether you were recounting the story you heard, or whether that was first person from you, do you recall?
Yes. It's a pretty horrific story. Do you remember it? Do you remember? The story was the woman came in she was having problems with making love with her husband, and it just wasn't working, and he did an hypnosis. She went back, and she had an experience in her body and a vision, a memory, as though she were there, of being back in Europe,
She saw the cobblestone streets. She saw the four soldiers approaching. Her body responded like this, and I kept trying to say it was okay, and then didn't need to stop. No, this is really important, right? And then she talked to her mother, and her mother, she told the story to her mother, and her mother was so startled. And she said, I have never told anyone this story. The daughter had remembered it exactly the way it had happened. The vision of it, everything. The mother told her the story. And what I recounted was her words of the story, if that makes sense. Is that what you're asking?
That makes sense. That's just...
Yeah. It really woke me up.
That will wake you up.
To think that an embryo 12 weeks could have a vision and a story and a memory that was stored in her body all this time and was affecting her in her current relationship with a man that she adored, you know. And when we worked on that, she was able to move on. Yeah, which you know, yes. Yes.
I have to ask, is there an overall generalization of what happens to children of rape?
I don't have a generalization. No, in fact, I don't really like generalizations, but we do certainly make them enough. But if you can imagine, a rape is a horrific trauma, and then if there's a pregnancy, the mother is in a double bind. She has a life growing inside of her. There were a lot of cases, I think I talked about this last time, in Eastern European countries, that France had a policy for a while that a woman that conceived through rape could come to Paris, have her child, leave the child, and go home. And as you know, can you imagine, these babies did not thrive. And Miriam Chazier was a psychoanalyst, and she said, you know, I wonder what would happen if we found out the story from the mother. And so before the mother left, she would take copious notes about the mother, about the family, about the history, and about what happened. And Miriam, being the psychoanalyst that she was not going to touch her patient. And so the nurse would bring this tiny infant who was not thriving, and Miriam would tell this baby the story about the mom and about what happened, and say, you know, you're going to have a good adoptive family. Somebody is wanting you right now, and he's going to love you. Mm-hmm. And these children begin to thrive. Mm-hmm. So it's not what happens to us, it's how we make sense of and what we do with what happens to us. What we believe about ourselves as a result of what happens to us. It's never too late to have a happy childhood, right? Okay, I'm loving this question. This is great. Yes, and then, okay.
Can anybody and everybody be hypnotized?
Now that is a good question.
Peter,
would you like to answer that?
What I found is that hypnosis, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis.
Yes.
You're in charge.
Yes.
And if you allow it to happen, it's just simply focused concentration.
That's right.
Where you're aware of everything that's going on around you, you're just deeply relaxed.
Right.
It feels great.
It does.
So get out of the way and allow yourself to go there, and you have access to so much information about yourself
right.
that can then help you heal.
Right.
Because you may have created the problem, but the problem was created, you can uncreate it.
That's
and
right.
become whole again.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. It's
amazing.
It's pretty amazing. Yes. Oh wait, I'm sorry, I told her first and then I'll come to you.
We haven't said anything about babies that can't keep their food down. For 2 weeks when I was born, it kept up.
The gut, and I could be wrong about it, there are many things, but sometimes the mom may be anxious. There may be some obstruction, there may be some reason, but a lot of times it's anxiety. And an interesting piece
we're talking about, and we're not going to get into it today, but I was thinking when you were talking, Michael, about polyvagal theory, which happened phylogenetically as we, let me see how I can shorten this. What happens when we're born is that we can't, I may have mentioned this last week, we can't crawl to our mothers. We're one of the few mammals that can't crawl to get our needs met. But we are cute. And we can turn our heads, right? We can have eye contact. And we can make sounds. And that supposedly engages the mother. And when that happens, there's a nerve, the polyvagal nervous system, which is part of the gut, begins to say, okay, can I relax and digest food, or do I need to be aware and on guard? If I can relax and digest food, then the nerve begins to grow in the heart space, which is the relational, right? And then it comes to the human voice. And with the turning of the head, with the all of this, the cooing, the mother's voice, if the mother is in tune and can understand, because her mother was in tune with her, she has the nervous system in place. She has the structure that can hear the cry of a baby as a distressed cry. Some mothers can hear a baby's cry and think, ah, they'll be fine. They'll cry out. You know, and I just go, oh, my God, pick that baby up, right? So I don't know what happened, but sometimes if this isn't as developed as it needs to be, then that could have an effect on the digestive system for a long time. Yeah. Yes.
I would like to tell you something. I sent someone to Peter.
Oh, good.
Who does like past life regressions.
Can anybody hear her?
No.
I should say?
Yeah, here.
That's right.
Oh. So just speaking.
All right, thanks. I sent someone to Peter 25 years ago who every person she was with, she came to me for some therapy. All the men in her life hit her and beat her and hurt her. Well, she went to Peter, and in the regression, during her mother was pregnant with her, the sister came and hit the mother on the stomach and said, "We don't have money." She came from Russia, they were very poor. So that was the first violent hit. And once she had the hypnosis and told Peter about it, he gave her probably some ideas. She's been in loving, kind relationships ever since.
Wow. Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. So it's just a great example that whatever our life pattern is has some kind of beginning at the beginning. And when we discover that and elevate it and let it go, yes.
Another way to break that life pattern is through the Feldenkrais method.
Yes.
A process called awareness through movement.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to tell everyone on the internet, it's called openatm.org, which stands for awareness through movement.
Yes. Openatm.org.
Correct. And you can just go and want you in a place to lie down and just take a lesson over the internet, and it will give you the ability to observe yourself and find that open space where you can discover the patterns that you have in yourself that are
It's fascinating. Fascinating how we carry these patterns in our bodies, and something like this, the Feldenkrais can be very, very helpful. Thank you for that.
But I still cry a lot.
Who's the lady? Say it again? I'm sorry.
Used to cry a lot.
Yeah, I still do, but I think from a medication.
Oh, medication. Yeah.
I cry a lot. Still, I don't cry because I'm Dr. Spencer.
Right. And your mother was taking, when she, say the first part of what she said.
You know, I think medication, I think side effects of my medication.
Oh, a side effect. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It makes me cry, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Medication can have various side effects, and it's something to pay attention to and see if there's some kind of support that you need around that. Yeah.
What kind of support?
Thank you. I don't know. I don't. I talked to the doctor who prescribed it, I think. Yeah, I know. Yes.
I have a friend who adopted a child who was a, I'm not sure she was a crack baby, but she and her mother had been on, mm-hmm. on drugs. Mm-hmm. And it's apparently a whole pattern of behavior that,
yes.
that it is not necessarily neurological, it comes from
right.
these kinds of stories.
Yes.
And it's been very interesting to follow that story, and you're mentioning the acting out
yeah.
during at pubescence
oh,
or
yes.
teen years. That was, I mean, the daughter's great now,
yeah.
but it was during that period of time.
It's hard.
When she really, really had to act down.
Mm-hmm.
I guess
mm-hmm.
to work it through.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. I think we go back to that, and we're always, I think we're always pushing ourselves toward wholeness, and when we're always saying, hey, I need some help, or I know I can get through this, you know, and that's what she was doing, and it sounds like she had some support, which she didn't have in the beginning, to do that.
It's very interesting, there's a whole movement in the United States to support adopted parents.
Yes. Huge.
Drug influence.
Yes.
Babies.
Yes.
And even to the point where there's a system in some states where parents who have these children register with the police because they know that the children are going to act out and blame their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get a doctor's
right.
you know, saying if the child calls up and said they're beating me or abusing me
right.
or things like that, this is one of those children, so handle it in a different
mm-hmm. If they have a diagnosis, not all children that are adopted, but certain children who were abused or had drugs, and mother had drugs or that kind of thing.
No, it's all right. I wanted to make sure I got
yes.
one thing in, and then we'll open it up again. Can I do this?
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, in terms of your own life and what the patterns are, I don't know if I this just came to me, so I haven't done this. I can't tell you this is going to work for sure. If you wrote a one sentence biography, I think what, because I just did it for myself, I think what you would find would be your birth or your gestation and birth and very early experience somehow,
mm-hmm.
like a one sentence biography and not a nice one. It's truthful a one as you could say, you know. So you would say something like, you know, I have had the best intentions, but I never seem to accomplish them. You know, that kind of thing. That would be a statement about difficulty in the last stage of birth, having to do with making a promise into a reality.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
Just because I know you're all thinking, what you can get it through your body, but you,
mm-hmm.
you intellectually you know it. If you said, what is the basis of me? What in one sentence? What is my life story? That would be your early story.
That's really excellent. And also, if you want to do an exercise, look at your comings and goings. How do you say goodbye? Do you slip out the door? What do you do in transitions? Are transitions easy for you? What happens to you when you have to make a big decision? Those kinds of things can tell you a lot about where you get stuck. Okay?
That's great about the saying goodbye. Some people, they don't even say goodbye.
No.
Other people, it's like a half an hour process. That's a long way.
Don't worry. Exactly. One or two more questions, then we have to stop.
I have a question. If you're aware of what you're going through, and the question is, what therapist would I choose? And how do I choose a therapist?
See me and I'll make some recommendations. Truthfully, all trained a lot of therapists. Therapists don't get trained in this, and it's too bad, but it's coming, you know. Infant mental health people, I was on a consortium a couple years ago, and they added prenatal to the definition of infant mental health, and instead of saying 0 to 3, they're now saying pre to 3. So we're moving in that direction. But there's not a lot of training in this. No. And certainly, Peter, you could be a wonderful resource as well. Yeah.
So look, just an addition to that, look, you can ask the therapist, you know, what is your orientation, and do you do anything with the body?
Right.
Look, body people have a tendency to know this.
Right.
Or people that have an orientation that includes this rather than staying on an adult intellectual level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of just behavioral therapy is very helpful for some situations. But if you want to go deeper, you have to do more than talk about it, which is where you start. You know, you have to go into the body, you have to go into some other processes, because that's where the memories are, that's where the stuck places are. It's not just thinking about it, okay? Okay, well, last question, and then we're going to go. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I never thought about it before, but some of those early birth experiences may work themselves out in occupations we pick. I had apparently a very difficult birth experience. My father told the attending physician at one point, you know, if it's a choice between the mother and the child, always I will choose the mother. So it was a very difficult breech birth. Mm. And apparently I was turned around. I don't think forceps were used.
Mm-hmm.
But
I
was making a connection. I play bass, upright bass, the big one, in jazz groups. And bass is a very important anchor instrument.
Yes.
You're counted on for excellent time and the roots and fifths of the chord structure. And people sometimes say, if the bass isn't happening, nothing's happening.
That's right.
It's such a foundation anchor instrument. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, probably I'm working through some of the anxiety of the birth process by picking a foundation instrument.
Wow.
And constantly working on that.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And I'm sure a lot of you have as well. Thank you so much for being so generous.
Thank you so much, Marty. Okay, two things. First, is there any art? Okay, Richard, you have a thing you wanted to ask.
Well, I haven't been asked to be coming up with this conversation class. I don't know if my name is at all. I'm 94, so I could go to class. I just thought I'd put it out there if anybody knows of a room to rent that I can, you know, maybe have a permanent place to stay. You know, I wouldn't be there all the time, but it'd be a place that I could go so I could take more classes while I'm trying to transition to possibly move to Santa Barbara. So I just thought, you know, I just would, you know, we're out there, anybody go.
Okay, so if you do know of a room, and you can email me, and then I will get in touch with Richard. He is a responsible, reputable, nice, good person. Okay, I can vouch for him. Okay. Okay, so Abraham, why don't you read your poem? And me, your poem. Okay, so if you need to leave, tiptoe out. We have two poems, so Abraham, why don't you come up and then leave.
Some of you may have heard the story of the priest and the three ships. But I'm going to tell it to you in a poetic form. Surrounded by a calm, infinite ocean, after a mighty storm came to pass, a priest awakened to a ruins of a ship, clutching a wooden piece to stay afloat. Ask God to save him, as any priest would naturally do. Expecting a miracle, a beam of light from heaven to carry him aboard. A ship was sailing by, asking to jump aboard or die. No, no, thank you, I'm confident God will save me, was his reply. Two other ships did the same. The priest insisted on God's miracle, dead as he stood in front of God, angrily shouting, why did you let me die? God replied, I send you three ships to rescue thee. You refuse to board and flee.
Okay, we got one more. Okay.
What's happening? I'm drawn into my fears by courage, to the darkness by a ray of light, pulled through chaos by silence. My weakness seduced by might. I'm not denying my wholeness. And I don't have any chagrin. I'm simply exposing fresh essence by shedding my current skin. Oh.
Have a wonderful 3 weeks, folks. We'll see you in 3 weeks.